The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today we're going to deal with something that's been a theme of this show, a theme of my life and career for a very, very long time, if not the theme of my life and career, as well as this show and my writing and everything else. And that is the relationship between the Orthodox Church and the political concept of nationalism. And, of course, it's right in the title of this show. The title, you could be read at numerous levels. One level is that the Orthodox Church is itself a nation of sorts. And we view that as our primary loyalty. Or the concept of nationalism itself really only coming into its own when it is connected to the Orthodox faith. Nationalism, in my opinion, by itself is not particularly interesting unless it has ultimately a spiritual end. Solidarity and unity, these are good things, but they're not really good things in and of themselves. They're good because they lead to a greater spiritual purpose. And so today we're going to do this. We're going to deal with two individuals that I've been wanting to talk about for a long time, and I keep forgetting about it. And what they have in common is that they are both very national-minded individuals. The first is an Irish saint, Saint Colman of Lindisfarne, who dies in 676. And the other is Saint Job Boretsky, who we've dealt with on this show before, a much later figure, who defended the national and ethnic traditions of Ukraine against all comers. So the point here, of course, is that we're dealing with two very different people. Two people, while sharing the same faith, live in two completely different historical eras. They live in two very different parts of the world. Their political and social and economic context couldn't be any more different, and yet they are absolutely identical in the faith that they maintain, but for our purposes, they're also identical in the fact that they are both nationalists in the best sense of the word. So for the first half of the show, I'm going to deal with St. Colman. The second half, I'm going to deal with St. Job. Now, St. Colman was a monk of the very famous Irish island of Iona, and eventually became the bishop of Lindisfarne. He viewed the Irish and Celtic Church as being ethnically different, while of course not disagreeing in matters of faith with anybody else. The more important idea was that the typical established Irish and Celtic customs be maintained. And this is particularly the case at a time where both the British Church, the Church of Northumbria specifically is what I'm referring to here, but as well as Point Salve, and the See of Rome, both viewed the Irish as ignorant, as more or less savage, as basically children. And so St. Colman is going to defend the Irish usages, in terms of liturgy, in terms of the calendar, in terms of other things, partially at least, as a defensive mechanism in really defending the Irish people and the Irish Church specifically from the attacks of both the sort of Romano-British mentality as well as a simple Roman mentality. And I want to stress that the Irish Church at the time is very different. It had a different calendar. It used the Gallican liturgy, at least for the most part. It used the vernacular, at least in certain circumstances. But also at the same time, because of these differences, and because of a lot of the ignorance visited against the Irish people, St. Colman is very interested in defending the Celtic tradition against others who view it negatively. It should also be noted that this period of time sees another major battle over the calendar. In this case, the distinction between the Gaelic calendar, which derives from the usage of St. John, the apostle, and the Roman calendar. And the Roman calendar, we're referring to the common Julian calendar that was common throughout the Roman world. Now, many of you know the famous Synod of Whitby, which decided in favor of Roman customs over and against the Gaelic and Irish customs. In many ways, this was an absolutely unnecessary battle. It insisted on absolute uniformity throughout all of the British Isles, and it caused, like all of these kind of, you know, ham-handed methods of enforcement, created a schism. And the schism didn't lead to these people who defended the so-called schismatics from being rejected, of course, because St. Colman was the leader of the so-called schismatics, and yet is still a saint in the Orthodox Church and in the Roman Catholic Church, and to a lesser extent, the Anglicans. But once the Synod of Whitby concluded, those people, led ultimately by St. Colman, needed to vacate the properties of their monasteries and schools and libraries and found new ones so as to maintain the Celtic tradition over and against the Roman. And it should be noted that, you know, even those who supported the Irish usages didn't have any problem with Rome as such. They all viewed Rome as the Mother Church of the West. But what that means, you know, these ideas of Rome being the first among equals, or Rome being the Mother Church or the center of Western Christendom, these don't necessarily imply any kind of juridical control. The Synod of Whitby, to some extent, was one of the original ways by which Rome tightened its grip on those parts of Western Europe that did not conform to its usages. We're not talking about theology here. And this is the problem that St. Colman dealt with, and it's why it's so essential to understand him in the history of ethnic and religious nationalism, because Colman is not disagreeing with Rome in terms of basic theology and the canons. It is not disagreeing with Rome as the center of Western Christendom. Those are not the issue. What's the issue is that Rome does not have the authority, although it does have the power, it does not have the authority to legislate how historically constituted Orthodox people are to worship. This was the big issue. So that means, ultimately, St. Colman of Lindisfarne is defending the Gaelic usage, the Irish usage, the Celtic usage, and calendar and liturgy largely on ethnic and traditional grounds, because the issue of theology was not present. Now, the Venerable Bede, in his famous history, wrote at length on St. Colman. And Colman, by the way, I should note here that he was at Northumbria, because Northumbria was initially evangelized not so much by Rome, but rather by Iona, thanks to St. Oswald. And yet, monarchs like Oswy and bishops like Cedd had ultimately rejected the Irish usages, and as a result, rejected the Irish influence over the Northumbrian Church. St. Tuda was brought in to replace Colman as bishop in Northumbria. So here you have a situation where you have a saintly bishop who is deprived of his see based on the fact that he was willing to defend Irish usages, not because he in any way was doctrinally or liturgically deficient. So the Venerable Bede is our primary source, one of our only sources, for St. Colman's basic position and his approach to the post-Whitby British world. We need to remember, of course, that the church at Kent, Canterbury, as well as the Gauls, had basically accepted Roman practice. I mean, this is what he's told. I mean, he's told that the entire world has accepted the Roman practice and the Roman calendar, and therefore you should as well. St. Oswy, who was monarch in Northumbria at the time, claimed that the church, at least within his dominion, can't really be the church unless it maintains one rule of life, one monastic rule, one liturgy, one form of chant. And that idea became absolutely dominant at Rome. One of the reasons that Westerners should reject Roman jurisdiction and control is that the Roman Church, in the name of its own centralizing policy, destroyed and outlawed and banned the traditional liturgies of Western Europe. The Roman See had declared that the Gallican liturgy should be outlawed, that the much older version of the Rite of Salisbury should be outlawed, that the Mozarabic or the Romano-Hispanic liturgy of Spain should be outlawed, or at least only used, permitted, under very limited circumstances. And the reason was national. The Roman See viewed the differences in these liturgies as possible sources of ethnic consolidation and solidarity against Roman imperialism, an imperialism based on a certain form of internationalism. And Colman's argument was very simple. He simply started off by saying that there is nothing wrong with what we do. By your own admission, these practices, the differences in the calendar and things like that are well known, but these practices have produced saints. And if they have produced saints and everything else, then there's absolutely no reason for them to be harmed in any way. Unless, of course, this is more a political or economic form of domination, and of course having nothing to do with theology. Now, Colman, much later on, almost like an afterthought, cited the authority of St. John the Apostle, saying that our customs come directly from him, and that wasn't controversial, because the Roman legates, the rule of St. Ked, and the See of Winchester and everything else, York, all of these places admitted that the Irish customs have an apostolic background, and that of St. John the Apostle, the author of the Apocalypse. So the fact that it had an apostolic foundation was admitted by everybody. But people like Wilfrid were mocking and attacking the Celts based on the prestige of the Roman See. This had nothing to do, even ultimately, with the rights of ethnic groups to have their own tradition, the rights of these Gaelic churches to have their own way of life. It certainly had nothing to do with doctrine. Ultimately, as these debates unfolded in early medieval Ireland and in Northumbria, it came down to the fact that the Irish are ignorant and the Romans are the very epitome of civilization. In fact, the Roman See went so far as to say that we respect and love the liturgy of, or the Gallican services and the calendar and tradition of St. John the Apostle, and that ultimately St. John had used these methods in the East for the sake of converting the Jews. However, that's all irrelevant because, according to the arguments at Whitby and then after Whitby, Peter and Paul at Rome did things differently. They are our authorities, and therefore there is no ethnic or regional right to do things in a different kind of a way. And so Wilfrid in Northumbria held and argued against Coleman that St. John only used the old methods in order to satisfy Jews and to convert them. Using, for example, using almost exclusively the lunar calendar was used to convert Jews. It was never meant for general usage. Now, I don't think anyone really knows one way or the other if that's true, but St. Coleman immediately shot back and said, well, we have a saint who used these methods that we all know and love, and that's St. Columba. But then Wilfrid responded that, you know, saints aren't perfect. Only the See of Saints Peter and Paul in Rome has the authority and the power to solve these kind of problems. And ultimately, Columba, while a saint, the Roman Church said that he was a simpleton and a rustic, and really he can't be trusted as a proper authority for these relatively difficult issues. So what we're dealing with here is the nature of the Gaelic usage, and that included a version of the Gallican liturgy, the stress on the saints of Gaul, not to mention Ireland itself, obviously, a much stricter monastic rule, the lack of territorial jurisdiction for bishops, the complete dominance of abbots, married clergy in certain instances. These are some of the things that, and of course, the different calendar, where Easter didn't necessarily fall on a Sunday because it was strictly a lunar. And so Easter can fall in the middle of the week. And so you had two calendars at work in Northumbria, which meant that, you know, the Gaels were still fasting for Lent while the Romans and Romano-British were still were celebrating Easter. So for the sake of unity, this battle occurred. Coleman was not claiming that his practice should be the case everywhere, but just that it should be tolerated because it has legitimate apostolic backing and, of course, the authority of Saint Columba. Now, the problem is that ultimately it wasn't about doctrine. It was about the Roman See demanding it has full control not only over the doctrine of the faith, but it had the authority, the right, the power to make its preferences known concerning even minor practices and differences in ritual and in the way of life, even if they fully agree with the Roman Church in the faith. So this was a powerful precedent. We're still battling with this precedent today. The idea that the Roman See is the only civilized part of the West, and therefore, because of that high level of civilization and education, it has the right to dictate all practices to those throughout the Western world. Now, before we conclude this first half, this concept of St. Coleman, I want you to realize that you're talking about the argument here is based on ethnicity and how ethnic groups viewed one another. The Roman civilization, while not an ethnic group, certainly acted as one, in the sense that the Romano-British, like Ked and like Wilfred and like Oswy and these other people, heavily influenced by Rome and Canterbury, what this meant was that the British were adopting the Roman practice and therefore incorporating it within their specific ethnic background. And of course, St. Colman, for his part, was defending the Irish usage based on its apostolic background, based on the fact that it produced saints, but really also based on the fact that it's ours. The fact that this is what our fathers did, this is what our families have been doing for a long time, and because it's so well established and orthodox, you can't change it. So there is a very powerful ethnic component here. There also was something else. The Romans viewed themselves as an urban people. Urban, in their mind, meant sophisticated. It meant intelligent. It meant humanistic in its basic approach. And yet they viewed the Gaels. Of course, you know, Ireland did not have any major cities until the Vikings. Prior to the Vikings, there were no cities in Ireland. It was the monastery itself was as close as you came to a city. And therefore, you know, the rural people, they are rustic, and rustic means ignorant, and therefore we can dictate to them. So not only do you have a ethnic battle, but you have an attack on the countryside. And then, you know, the implication here is that Rome and only Rome has any right, that there is no such thing as local tradition if it doesn't agree with the Roman. And even the lives and the mentality of the saints mean absolutely nothing because these are only local usages. People like Colman and Columba, these were rustics, and they didn't understand the brilliance of Roman civilization. It should be noted, too, that the Roman legates at Whitby and afterwards were spending an awful lot of money to make certain that the Roman way of life be imposed upon the Irish. And there are even some people, and I'm not sure really where I fall here, but there are some people who hold this to be really the opening attack on this almost eternal battle between the British and the Irish. And this first division is whether or not there is to be local usage dominant within the faith, or the Roman usage should be then universal on the islands. And there's also another thesis that this is a precursor to the Norman invasion much, much later. Colman dies in 676, so we're talking, you know, much later. But most of you probably know that William the Conqueror had a papal seal for his invasion of England. And then Henry II had full papal permission for his eventual invasion of Ireland. So the battle between Gaelic and Roman over the issues of the calendar and language and everything else, this is a precursor to a lot of bloodshed and problems in Western Europe, and particularly between the Gaels and the Romano-British. So that is our first example of a very ethnic and nationalist approach to theology based on local language, custom, and tradition. And when we come back, we're going to go across Europe, and we're going to deal with a relatively similar situation in Ukraine about 1,000 years later. So hang in there. We'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. Let's return to The Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome back to The Orthodox Nationalist. We're actually dealing very specifically here today with orthodoxy and nationalism. And in doing that, we're not talking about just, you know, pure theory, but we're talking about two living individuals, two people who were alive, who walked the earth, who lived day to day, who represented, to a great extent, this constant interplay and identity between ethnic nationalism on the one hand and the ancient Orthodox faith on the other. We dealt with St. Colman of Lindisfarne, who made, among other things, powerful ethnic arguments in favor of the Gaelic usage over and above the imposition of the Roman rite and tradition. And now we are going to go across Europe about 1,000 years later to the life and thought of St. Joe Boretsky, who very explicitly was a Ukrainian, Ruthenian nationalist, and actually kind of organized his theology on that basis. And we're talking about two men, two very important saints, who were explicitly nationalist in their concept that the ethnic orientation of the church was absolutely essential for creating that solidarity and that popular and populist tradition that holds the church together. And so this needs to be taken, it can't be taken any too seriously. This is central. This is central to how the Orthodox Church views the world. And I'm talking about two people substantially before the 19th century, where allegedly this was the only time that nationalism really ever developed. And of course, as so much on this show, we're dealing with people long before the 19th century who accepted a nationalism as an ethnic and religious way to organize people and to create that unity and solidarity, which is so hard to find any other way. Okay, St. Joe Boretsky dies in 1631, so we're talking about almost exactly 1,000 years after St. Colman, but a very similar situation. St. Joe Boretsky is actually fighting a three-front war. The first is against Russian hegemony, that is to say, Moscow's hegemony over Ukraine. The second is Turkish hegemony over Ukraine. And the third is Polish. Technically, there are actually two others, the Jewish attack on Ukraine and the Roman Catholic attack on Ukraine. And here you have a situation where Poles, Jews and Roman Catholics are working together to subvert the national and ethnic orthodoxy that Joe Boretsky is very explicitly defending as Metropolitan of Kiev. We've spoken on this program before about how after the Polish Empire attempted to impose Catholicism on Ukraine through using the Eastern Rite with Roman Catholic theology, which we call the Unia, created a huge division in Ukrainian society. And since the Ukrainians were simply so poor and illiterate to fight back, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, Theophanes, traveling to Russia, consecrated a number of monks to become bishops over a independent and renewed Ukrainian church. And one of these people was Joe Boretsky. Boretsky was very explicitly an ethnic nationalist in his approach to orthodoxy. And he was very close to two branches of that ethnic tradition. The first was the Cossacks, and the second was the Urban Brotherhoods. Both of these groups are pro-orthodox. The Cossacks, you couldn't be a Cossack if you were Roman Catholic. And the Brotherhoods were really an urban guild that was designed to preserve Orthodoxy and to teach Orthodoxy and to support the Orthodox Church financially and in some cases militarily. And he was consistently rallying the Cossack host throughout Ukraine to defend the cause of Orthodoxy against Islam, Catholicism, Judaism, and to a great extent the church in Russia, in Moscow. The problem with Moscow at the time, of course, is that she is drowning in blood because of the time of troubles, and so Russia wasn't quite the threat that she was later to become. And Boretsky is making a very explicit historical argument. The concept, he has a very specific philosophy of history, which is based around the ethnic distinction between old Rus or old Kiev and then what developed to the east in Moscow. For St. Job, the Cossacks are the only surviving remnant of Kievan Rus, or medieval Ukraine. They are the last remaining remnant in that they maintain the ethnic and religious and basic political and economic point of view that you had in medieval Kiev. And the result here is that that old tradition is being undermined by this. And for St. Job, really the two elements were the Turks and the Poles. The Turks and the Poles are working together to destroy any sense of ethnic Ukrainian solidarity, and they're being welded together by the Jews. The Jews, being probably the wealthiest element in Polish society, are using both pillars, Poland and Turkey, to destroy the resurgence of any Ukrainian Orthodox movement represented primarily by the the Metropolitan of Kiev, Job Boretsky. When St. Job blamed the Jews for this and was very, very loud in condemning the Jews for using pretty much any group that they could get their hands on to destroy the Orthodox tradition in Ukraine, the Roman Catholics were outraged at this terrible anti-Jewish idea. So suddenly, the Polish Catholics were defending the Jews because they were promoting their interests. So the Polish aristocracy in that part of the world had condemned the Cossacks when they attacked the Jewish settlements in Bielicerka, because the Cossacks were saying that these are the financiers of the Turkish and Polish movements in Ukraine. They have no right to be in Ukraine. They are occupiers, and Jews are here financing and paying for these occupiers and engaging in propaganda on their behalf, and therefore they are vulnerable to attack. We have every right to attack them because they're in the process of using pretty much anybody to attack us. So when the Cossacks hit the Jewish settlements there, the Polish government was just absolutely outraged at this violation of their liberty. And ultimately, I think the theory or the basic strategy that Boretsky had was to bring the Cossacks under his control so that he can then use them as a battering ram against the Poles and against the Roman Church. And as all of this was going on, it should be noted that the Cossacks were winning victories in the pay of Poland against Turkey, which is why the Cossacks were tolerated in the first place, because they were being used against Turkey. But because of the attack on the Jews that were financing the Polish aristocracy at the time, even as the Cossacks were bleeding against the Turks, the Poles still wanted to destroy them. They were quite willing to risk Turkish occupation rather than deal with an Orthodox Ukraine. And one of the ways they did this was to ban this new hierarchy that the Theophanes had consecrated and to ban St. Job from ever taking his see in Kiev. St. Job, this period of time, the 1620s, in particular, are doing everything in their power to increase the educational and economic level of Ukraine that had been devastated by constant wars with Turkey, constant battles with Poland, and the arrogance of the Jews working for the Polish government. Wodecki was the leader of the ethnic Ukrainian Orthodox movement. But the most important thing to remember here is that Wodecki is explicitly and deliberately making an ethnic argument. Because even Orthodoxy, while it's a true religion, no matter who accepts it, what their ethnic background is, in our particular case, here in 1620s Ukraine, it is the Ukrainian or Ruthenian religion. So he's making, you know, a very similar argument to St. Coleman. Orthodoxy, in our particular method of expressing it, is good and should be tolerated because it's ours. This is what our fathers did. And so when a lot of people, like Smotrycki and many others, abandoned Orthodoxy and went into the Polish Unia, they weren't just wrong. They weren't just schismatic. They weren't just heretics in that they accepted Roman Catholic definitions. But they were also traitors. They were traitors to their own Ukrainian people. And as far as Wodecki was concerned, you couldn't be Ukrainian or Ruthenian. And I'm using those two words interchangeably. At the time, a Ruthenian and Ukrainian were the same thing. You couldn't be both a Roman Catholic and a Ukrainian. That didn't make any sense to him. Wodecki was not in favor of any union with the Roman Catholics, and pretty much the only way that he thought was that the people could escape this kind of dominion was for a real Ukrainian patriarch directly under Constantinople. It should be noted here that Ukrainian nationalism at the time, to a lesser extent today, revolves around using the ancient see of Constantinople as a way to maintain independence against Moscow. You have to remember that one of the things that drove Ukrainians to support the Polish Union, the so-called Unia, was the very low level of education in rural Ukraine at this period of time. It's not the fault of the country, of course. It was ravaged. But when the Jesuits moved into Poland, they set up very dynamic schools and institutions and were churning out first-class graduates that then went on to proselytize among the Orthodox population. Orthodox people were going over to Catholicism while maintaining the Eastern traditions in hopes that they could use it as a way to enjoy the fruits of the education of Western civilization. And so that group of men, consecrated by Theophanes, they became the very nucleus of a resurrected Orthodox Ukraine, but a specifically ethnic and traditional and rural Ukraine. So you have a very similar situation to what you had in Northumbria 1,000 years earlier. This notion that the great civilization of Krakow in its urban sophistication is infinitely superior to anything that exists in the Ukrainian countryside. And the Ukrainians are a farming people, they're a landed people, and therefore they're an ignorant people. That's the exact same argument the British were using against the Irish at the time of the Synod of Whitby. So now you have two examples of an Orthodox people who are under attack, not merely on ethnic grounds, but also on the grounds that they are rural, and because they're farmers, they must not know anything. And what they do know, they know only through imitation. The one thing that the Ukrainians had at this time that the Irish did not have was the Cossack host that was completely dedicated to defending Orthodoxy against all comers. So you have St. Job and his successor Isaiah of Kiev. You have these two men both coming directly from the see of both Constantinople and Jerusalem to an argument based on the sanctity of Orthodoxy primarily, but secondarily, and just as important, the idea that this faith is something held by the Ukrainians for a very long time and has therefore become a national faith. So they made both an ethnic and a religious argument in favor of the preservation of Orthodoxy, and the exact same thing occurred in Ireland, or in Northumbria, I should say, from the mentality of St. Colman and the ideas both of Lindisfarne and Iona. The Irish didn't have much of a chance at the time because of the overwhelming prestige of Rome, but the prestige of Rome also was very important in 1620s Ukraine, because it was this urban Latin-speaking civilization represented by the Jesuits in Poland and Hungary. This was sophistication. This was progress. And by comparison to the very low educational level of the Ukrainian farmer at the time, it was an impressive argument against Orthodoxy. The faith as such was not really all that significant. Now, of course, by 1620, there's huge differences between Roman Catholicism and the Orthodox Church. But when you read the polemics of this era, between those who were pro-Union, those who were anti-Union, those who were pro-Constantinople, those who were pro-Moscow, the faith wasn't important. In fact, the Jesuits went out of their way to eliminate these kind of doctrinally based arguments because they wanted people to come to the Roman Church under the guise of the Eastern Liturgy based on the fact of Rome's prestige and the educational and economic abilities of the Jesuits and the Polish aristocracy. And the Jews were behind the scenes financing these people, but also helping to finance the Turks as well. Because if the Polish armies and the Turkish armies slaughter each other, then all you end up having is Jewish supremacy with a very weak and ignorant Ukrainian group of people. Now, this is why the brotherhoods were so essential, because these brotherhoods were relatively informal gatherings of Orthodox men in the cities for the sake of mutual edification and education. That's why they were so significant. The brotherhood schools and the schools that will develop a little bit later, and the Konstantin Ostrovsky's estates and everything else, these are the response to Jesuit education. So by the time St. Peter Mozilla will develop his school at the Kiev Caves Monastery, he will model it on Polish Jesuit sources. Not necessarily because he was a Polish citizen at one point, but more significantly, the concept was that if we're going to fight the Roman Catholics, we are going to need Roman Catholic methods, because regardless of the differences in faith, their form of education is actually brilliant, and that's what we have to use. So Peter Movilia is speaking Latin, he's writing in Latin, and he's using Jesuit and scholastic methods in order to defend Orthodoxy. But for our purposes, the most significant element is that Job Boretsky, who was before these people, is holding to a very specific ethnic and Ukrainian particularism as one of the primary pillars of his attacks on the Jesuits, the Poles, and without doubt the Jews. And Ukrainian politicians have a history of backing the Turks as a weapon to use against the Poles. But it was Zhoboretsky who accused the Jews of financing both sides. But as far as Job was concerned, only the Orthodox Church can maintain this level of solidarity amongst the Ukrainian people, because this is the faith of our fathers. This is the faith of the ethnos here in Ruthenia. Everything else is an alien imposition, especially the arrogance of the Polish Jesuits. So what do we have? By way of conclusion, there are clearly important parallels between the worlds of St. Coleman and St. Job. They both defended ethnic particularism. They both defended the Orthodox faith against Rome. Now, the big difference was that, of course, Coleman didn't disagree doctrinally. Job did disagree doctrinally. That the problem is that once things like purgatory and created grace were dogmatized at the Council of Trent, if not before, you couldn't be Orthodox and Catholic at the same time. People like Smotrytsky were saying that, well, these additions aren't really that important. Subtracting from the faith is a bad thing, but adding to the faith isn't that big of a deal. But since purgatory is based on the idea of created grace, and created grace in turn is based on the concept of the Pope, and the Pope alone has the right to dispense grace to whoever he wants, that suddenly became a huge doctrinal difference based on the power of the papacy. Either grace is created and hence is in the hands of the Pope to give to whoever he wants, or the grace of the resurrection is present everywhere and can be accessed, so to speak, by the sacraments and the lifestyle and the way of thought of the Orthodox Church. Those two can't be combined because they're inherently contradictory. So this is a huge difference between Coleman and Job, and that you did have this substantial doctrinal distinction. But like I said, these doctrinal issues were not nearly as significant as they later were to become. The only way you could square that is to say that the notion of absolute Roman control is in fact a doctrinal opinion. And clearly there were some people at the time in Britain who held to that point of view. But the most specific element here is that you have two saints using the exact same kind of argumentation, even to the point where Joe Boretsky is saying, no, the Ukrainian church is based on the missionary work of St. Andrew the Apostle, who absolutely was on the Black Sea. How far he penetrated into the Slavic world is another matter. But all the major church historians of the ancient world explicitly say that St. Andrew was in Scythia and was on the Black Sea and evangelized that part of the world. So you have St. Coleman claiming an ethnic tradition of the church based on St. Columba and then in turn St. John the Apostle. You have St. Joe Boretsky claiming the same ethnic tradition based on St. Andrew. So all of these different arguments ultimately came together with the idea of, or to the idea, of ethnic solidarity. Ethnic solidarity in and of itself isn't necessarily good or bad. Ethnic solidarity in and of itself could be based on terrible things. It could be based on simply the dead weight of tradition rather than the living faith. The living faith can vivify tradition to purge what is bad and keep what is good. And this is something that was very explicit in the early period of both Ireland, Britain, and Ukraine. And this ultimately was the argument that both of these men made. So to have these two people, two very different parts of the world, speaking different languages, living 1,000 years apart, but having the same faith, making the exact same argument concerning this ethnic particularism being leavened, so to speak, by the Holy Spirit, the canons of the church, etc., etc. That's remarkable and shows and proves beyond a doubt, in my opinion, that ethnic nationalism, when understood precisely in this way, is a very important, significant tradition in the church and can never be ignored. This isn't some kind of aggressive nationalism based around state power. We're not even near that. Both St. Job and St. Coleman are making arguments based on the ethnic tradition that our fathers have used, and they were sanctified by it. They became saints because of it. They became martyrs because of it. They have apostolic background, and therefore they can't be gainsaid by the theory by the theory of papal supremacy. Now, of course, the contexts are very different, but the argument is identical, and that's what I want to get across tonight. And I appreciate you guys listening, and I thank you for supporting this show. If I've made any errors in this show or before, I apologize for that. I apologize if I've hurt anybody's feelings on this show. I know I do that on occasion. And I do apologize for that. And I really appreciate you and the Voice of Reason and people like Mike Connor. Mike Connor is working around the clock, in some cases quite literally, to make sure that this show and all the others are on the air and our writings and everything get promoted the way that they should. And I want to thank him, and I want to thank you, and good night, and I'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Radio Aryan.